Well, good. You don't have to watch the Bears game because they're winning and they'll probably win, and you'd much rather listen to my guest, Chris Jones. This is Rick Cogan. The show is After Hours. And Chris, even though he sits next to me and we talk to each other, I don't know. We're like some weird, someone goes like, who's your office wife? And I always go, well, it's Chris Jones. It's the only person I talk to there. We sit next to each other, and there's nobody in this business at this time that I admire more. And I was very excited about his book, and I read it over the weekend. It is called Rise Up, Broadway, An American Society from Angels in America to Hamilton. Chris, how are you?
I'm good. What a pleasure.
This is a great book.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
It's very provocative on a number of levels. The two minor quibbles I have about it, we'll talk about at the office, because otherwise I just want to rave about it. It is, how did this book come to be? Was this your notion? I mean, it's very interesting that it begins with, of all those great theater characters in America, Mike Pence. But but how did this, I mean, when did it occur to you? Certainly there are some bookends in Angels in America and Hamilton being.
Well, I think the moment the idea came, I'm sitting in the Tribune Tower, as where we were at that point, watching the Tony Awards, to write about the Tony Awards. This would be 2016. And then they're in a commercial break, and then they come back from a commercial, and there is Barack Obama and Michelle Obama on the screen, and they are saying essentially, ladies and gentlemen, you know, here's Lin-Manuel Miranda of Hamilton fame. And I remember looking at that and thinking, okay, that's interesting. I don't think a sitting president, as he was at that point, a sitting president has ever, on the Tonys, on the Oscars, on the Emmys, has ever effectively done a commercial for a show.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking,
well, as you write near the end of the book, you write, politicians, let alone presidents, usually stayed away from the theater.
Yes.
Which they feared would either trivialize them or bring them into uncomfortable contact with dangerous radical artists.
That's right. I mean, that was sort of how it was. And so I thought to myself, this is a sort of an astounding thing. So I thought, maybe there's a book in how did theater, you know, get to the center of the American conversation, which is what it achieved with Hamilton. How did it get to the point where you had a president actually effectively doing a promo for a guy on the Tony Awards?
Take us back to it's bookended. Chris's incredibly compelling. It's a driving narrative. It's not just, hey, this play was about this. It's anecdotal. It's all sorts of things. Remind people of the potency and power of Angels in America.
So Angels in America was this incredible play in, 1992. Tony Kushner, this great writer, had somehow written this play that was all about, he got the idea after he got the idea in a dream. And of course, he was writing the play in the middle of an AIDS crisis. And the thing about the AIDS crisis was, I think, and you know, because you lived through this,
sure,
and you went to a lot of these funerals.
Oh, yeah.
You went to a lot of funerals of young people, and anyone who is anywhere around the theater or the arts was constantly going to these, churches where you would often see an alienated family from the person who had died. And then instead of hymns, there would be often show tunes. And there would be tears. And there would be a lot of friends in the room.
Well, almost, and those friends comprised, in my thing, because I did see a lot of those alienated people, that was their real family. It was another family.
That was, in fact, their family.
Yeah.
That's right. That was the replacement for the family. And so Tony Kushner at that point, was this sort of socialist, a sort of socialist ideas guy. But I think that, and really a secularist, that is to say, I don't think prior to any of this that Tony really believed in God.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what happened in the early 90s, if you went to too many funerals of very young people, and if you had no faith in anything, it completely destroyed you. And I think that at that point, he wrote this play, which was about, okay, everybody's dying too young. How do I reconcile that with the fact that I don't like organized religion? So he didn't like, he was critical of Mormonism. He was critical of Judaism, even though he was a Jew himself.
Sure, sure.
Just the doctrinaire aspects of it. But it was a sort of a searching for spirituality.
Well, he was certainly critical of the political structure too.
Oh my God, yes. God,
yeah.
So there's that great, you know, there's Roy Cohen in the play, of course. You know, and Roy Cohen didn't go away. I mean, Roy Cohen was in fact an advisor to Trump, you know, Trump. The Trump family.
Yeah, I know.
So so the play was at once political, but also really a search for spiritual longing in every way. And it was this incredible play. If you were in Chicago in the early 90s, you may have seen it at the Royal George Theatre with the actor Jonathan Hanratty playing Roy Cohen, directed by Michael Meyer, who went on to be a great... And actually, of all the shows I've ever seen in Chicago, it was absolutely one of the very, very best.
You've seen thousands of shows.
Yeah, literally thousands.
You have seen thousands of shows. The show that follows it, you talk here, and it is, as I said, a great narrative drive, and we can't cover it all in the 45 minutes that Chris will be here. I was very taken with Chapter 2, which is the emergent power of the solo voice, but very taken. One of the shows that haunts me, in part because of it, the fate of its author, is Rent.
Rent, yeah. So, you know, Rent was this sort of remarkable show where you had this guy, Jonathan Larson, who wrote music that was some of the most beautiful music anyone had ever written for the theater. And he had, you know, on the eve, he's written this great show, he's done everything he can to get it out there, and then he dies sort of on the first preview.
I know.
And it's, you know, and it was one of the greatest losses. I barely a day, you know, I'm constantly thinking about if only Jonathan Larson had lived. I always think, when I wonder what would, there's three people that always intrigue me what they would have done if they'd lived. One was the great country composer Roger Miller, who wrote King of the Road, King of the Road. And he wrote this musical Big River and died. And then I always think of Lorraine Hansberry,
who wrote Raisin the Sun, one other play, and died.
And then I think.
35 at 35 or something.
Which is unbelievable.
And then Jonathan Larson.
And then Jonathan Larson, who basically wrote Rent and died. And he captured for me in Rent. He was a writer who wrote about what it was like to be young at the end of the 20th century. And he anticipated the alienation of technology. He anticipated the gentrification of cities. All of the things that we now worry about, I think, were in Rent.
Well, and also he drew to the theater. I mean, there were Rent heads, but he drew to the theater, I think, a young, vast young crowd that had not been previously as attuned to the theater. Am I wrong about
that? That's absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And the other thing, you know, they were the inventors of the lottery. So what they did was, in New York, they said, okay, for $20, you can get tickets for Rent. And there was a line outside the Niederlander Theater on 41st Street. There was a line, you know, three blocks long, of course, giving them great publicity. And then what happened is that all the rich people who wanted to be cool went to Rent. And they were all in the third row. And the first two rows were filled with young, hip people. And they felt like they were at an edgy experience, you know, something dangerous and edgy. And it was so, so brilliant how they had managed to do that.
You were just getting a sample of the depth and power and authority, I dare say, that exists in Rise Up Broadway and American Society, from Angels in America to Hamilton. It is, for those of you who think, well, it's a collection of reviews, it is anything but. It is a commentary on the world in which we live, as sort of through the prism of theater.
Yes.
And through the magnifying glass of theater. Stay tuned. Chris will be right back. His son, Evan, is in here, too, probably to tell his dad, Dad, you were terrible. Why didn't you mention me more? Welcome back, Rick Hogan, After Hours, Chris Jones sitting here, his son Evan sitting here. We are talking about Chris's new book, available now. You can get it. You can try to get it on Amazon, but for once, Amazon is kind of screwed up. You can get it at Target. It is called Rise Up, with an exclamation point, Broadway and American Society, from Angels in America to Hamilton. And it is if you like theater at all, you will love this book. It gives you a sort of understanding. It was enlightening to me, but it was also a great, great deal of fun. I loved Chapter 4, The Lion King Roars and the Family Returns to Broadway. I was terribly, terribly intrigued by your Las Vegas chapter, the Las Vegas influence on theater, because I hadn't been to Vegas in a great long time. And when I went to Vegas, I would see such acts as Mr. Electric, who was able to pull like 1,000 light bulbs out of his mouth, which is not great theater. Talk to me about that chapter, Chris. Fascinating to me.
I've had this lifelong fascination with Vegas.
Dollywood too.
That's right. So I started going to Vegas in the 90s when I was working for Variety, and at that point there was Vegas went through various different phases, and one of them was that it wanted a family audience.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was a period of time when they started producing shows there. And I, you know, one of my favorite Vegas stories is when they opened the Wynn Hotel, which is a beautiful hotel on the Las Vegas Strip, still there. And there was a guy there called Franco Dragone who had done a couple of great Cirque shows. One was called O, still playing, it's a water show, and one called Mystère. Anyway, the story, this is not in the book, but it's a good story. So he created... WGM bonus. And he created the show called La Rev, which is at the Wynn Hotel. And it's another water show. And Steve Wynn wanted was something nice for his gamblers. Get them back to the tables in 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. Classy experience. And there'd just been this tsunami. And Franco Dragone, who was a real artiste, actually built in the tsunami into the show, and he had all these pregnant women, characters representing pregnant women, washing up like dead on the shore in the show.
Gosh.
And I remember being at the table. So I came out of the show and I start playing blackjack. This is a great story. And my phone goes, and it's Steve Wynn. And the dealer's like, get away from the table. You can't use your phone. I said, it's Steve Wynn. He said, no, it's not. It's not Steve Wynn. I said, it is. So I step back from the table, and it's Steve Wynn. And he's like, I can't have that show. I just can't have that show. It's got to go. You know what? It's got to go. This is ridiculous. I thought this was a really surreal moment in my life. I'm arguing with Steve Wynn about the tsunami in La Rev, and he came in. And then if you go to see La Rev today, that's all gone. But there was a moment there, and it was a good story. And my other was I actually met Michael Jackson there. When I say met, I mean I was in the same room, and
Yeah.
And my memory is he had a deep voice. He said he was there with his kids, and he said hello. He's like down here, like this, and
like
I'm
me.
Like, yeah, it was like Rick
trying
Kogan.
To imitate
he
me.
Sounded like Rick Kogan, and I always thought, Michael, you expect a high squeaky voice, and didn't have a high squeaky.
Maybe
voice.
I should try to sing. Maybe I would sound like Michael Jackson if I tried to sing.
But your point is that the show in the 90s, Vegas made a big play for Broadway shows, and a lot of people, including Jeffrey Seller, who is the producer of Hamilton. Right now, essentially sold out to Vegas.
Yeah.
The Vegas checks were good, and they took their shows there.
I also think that it made people, over the years, a lot of people I've known have been sort of shy about going to the theater. They don't know how to dress. They don't know how to do this. I think Vegas sort of democratized theater.
That's
for
exactly
a
right.
lot of people.
That's exactly right. It made it, you know, it just sort of demystified it for a lot of people. But there was a period of time there where there was some serious shows in Vegas. There was a 90-minute Phantom of the Opera, which my memory of that is that, as you know, in Phantom, the chandelier comes down to the, you know, falls down. In the Vegas version, it flew down at such a pace that people would get out of their seat.
Scream.
People would scream. Ah! They'd get out of their seat. It was really something. And then the other great story is that, and this I believe to be a true story, is that Julie Taymor, so Disney hired Julie Taymor to do this show called The Lion King, which lasts, still playing, as you well know, 20-odd years. And they wanted, you know, Disney wanted somebody arty and sophisticated, and they certainly got that. So she walks into a meeting with Disney Suits, and, you know, remember that this is just based on the animated movie.
Yeah.
And she says, you know, in Act Two, I want everybody to go to Vegas. And all the Disney Suits are like, you want what? And she said, I want Simba and whatever the hell they're all called. They're all going to go. And they said, no, they're not.
that's a great story.
You know, that was, you know, you don't mess with Disney.
Well, I like the chapter on Vegas is great. Also, the chapter on Steppenwolf. And Steppenwolf had been to Broadway before many times.
Yeah.
With Gary Sinise and Malkovich. Yeah. It was different, however, when August Osage County, Tracy Letts's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, went there. Why was it different, Chris Jones?
Well, I remember sitting in Steppenwolf, this would be early in 2007, I remember sitting there watching Tracy's play. And at that point, Tracy wasn't a known quantity in the way he is now. He certainly wasn't known as a TV actor in the way he is now.
No, sure.
And I felt like he'd written a play that completely reinvented what we thought of as the great American family drama. It was I've always thought of it. It was similar to Eugene O'Neill or, you know, a sort of Long Day's Journey or Desire Under the Elms or one of those plays. But Tracy added a sort of a note of irony, a little bit of humor, a little bit of self-awareness. And so that show, of course, opens, goes to Broadway. It's this incredible play. It was many people listening to me talk went to see it. Everybody went to see it. It was a huge deal. Huge deal. And it opens on Broadway. And my memory of that opening night on Broadway is there was this guy with a New York accent, you know, right next to me. And it was like he'd been blown back in his seat by the power of the acting. He sort of went, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Like about three times in my ear. And I remember thinking, he's complete. It was Broadway had never seen acting like that. Yeah. And I think it reinvented what Steppenwolf was for another generation.
Oh, that's great. This book is really a masterful journey through a couple decades of American theater. Rise Up, Broadway and American Society, from Angels in America to Hamilton. We have to take a commercial break, Aubrey. Yeah, we got to get some commercials and some news, and we will finish up with Chris so he can get his kid Evan home talking about Spider-Man. We will get a special WGN bonus of his take on King Kong. And one of the great things, you look in the index of this book, if that's how you go shopping for books, and you look and you see, where's Andrew Lloyd Webber? And you go, wow, he's not in here.
No,
I'm going to buy this. I'm going to buy this book. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Well, thank you, Roger. It is time to get back to me. We're talking for about 10 more minutes about Chris Jones's remarkable book that would satisfy anybody looking at presents underneath a Christmas tree. When they opened it, they'd go, oh, my God, I love that Chris Jones. I heard him on Rick Hogan's show. I read him in the Tribune, because Chris is among the most prolific critics that I have ever encountered in modern American newspapering. There's another lovely chapter in the book. It's Broadway and American Society, from Angels in America to Hamlet. Lovely chapter on August Wilson. Then there is, the great thing about the book, I didn't expect a chapter on Vegas. I might not have expected your chapter on August Osage County. Then you have, and I'm using this only because you came back from New York, and I asked you before you'd written your review, what do you think of King Kong? And you told me, and you were a little kinder in print, because it is a family newspaper. But I had forgotten about Spider-Man, and there is a chapter devoted to...
So Spider-Man, you know, is one of the great disasters of all time. And like, it's an example of how on Broadway, you would think if there was a can't-miss project, it would be Spider-Man, right? Yeah. Built in, not only a superhero, but really the most super of all superheroes. The one with the highest recognition, the longest life, you know, the kind of brand A superhero. And they had, you know, all the various owners of Spider-Man. And then they hire Julie Taymor to do it, and they have this disastrous process whereby people are getting hurt at almost every performance.
Yeah.
It's like one dancer goes flying into space, lands bam in the bottom of the orchestra pit, and then they keep delaying their opening. And then finally, the various critics, I happen to be in New York, and the sort of the word goes out, everybody's going tonight. So I showed up at the box office of the theater, I bought myself a ticket, and I sat there, and I saw one of the most spectacularly terrible shows I think I've ever seen in my life. And it was completely incoherent. You couldn't follow it or anything. And it was and it was kind of wonderfully so.
Yeah.
But it was stunning. It was really stunning. And the amount of money just kept ballooning and ballooning. We got to 50 million, then we got north, close to, far north even of that. And it was, I think, perhaps the biggest disaster Broadway had ever seen. And it was just really, one problem after another. And eventually they cleaned it up a bit and they reopened and it was a little better, but it was not like that sort of spectacularly terrible opening. There was we think of it, there was Spider-Man 1.0, which was the original production. Yeah. Then there was Spider-Man 2.0, which was the improved production. Both of them were terrible. I actually preferred Spider-Man 1.0 because it was just spectacularly incoherent.
You know, you've seen thousands of plays, and it always, and we both seen thousands of movies, and it is always such a compelling mystery that when very big talents collaborate, yes, none of them are collaborating to do the worst job. They are all,
of course,
they all aspire to do the best job that they can. And when it screws up, it's astonishing.
I think that is the biggest question of all.
Yeah.
You mentioned King Kong, so I'm watching King Kong on Broadway, which opened about 2 weeks ago. And the problem with King Kong is not hard to grasp. The problem with King Kong is that the big monkey, they have a big puppet monkey, fantastic. It has these eyes that you can stare into. It picks up people. It's animatronic. It's got puppeteers. It's got it all going on. What they don't have is any relationship between the monkey and the lead woman, Ann Darrow, in the famous movie.
Yeah.
And there's no relationship. And theater, fundamentally, at all levels, is about relationships. And you're like, how did they get this far? How did they spend $35 million and not have some clue on that, the importance of that central relationship? And the answer is they probably didn't know they didn't have it, or they, I think these big shows, and what a lot of people don't always realize is that these days they are technologically complicated to the point where people make decisions early in the process. They know it's terrible sometimes, and they can't change it because it's $10 million to reprogram the computer.
Yeah.
And in the Mickey and Judy movies, you could put in a new number, the composer's in the hotel room, Sondheim's writing away upstairs, you can fix it. Now, very hard because of the technology involved.
Well, the book ends with a show you have written a great deal about, especially because it opened here and did a wonderful interview with Lin Miranda on stage at the Opera House or auditorium or something. How is Hamilton, Chris Jones, author of Rise Up, Broadway and American Society from Angels in America to Hamilton, how is Hamilton going to reshape, if it is, American theater? Because I've got to believe that there are guys in every, fourth floor walk up in Manhattan going, come on, we got to do more hip hop. We got to put hip hop into the script. Do you know what I mean? A hit of that magnitude has a ripple effect that can be beneficial and also disastrous.
Well, you bring up a lot of good points there. You know, one of them is you can't replicate a hit. If everybody knew what the next hit was, everybody would have it, and you wouldn't make all the money you make when you get one, because there's no secret source. People don't know until it hits. So that I think is absolutely true. One of the things I wanted to do in this book a bit was to talk about ambition, right? So I was doing a talk last week, actually in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan, and I was in this class of theater kids, and I sort of said to them, most theater kids had to talk their parents into letting them be theater majors, and they always feel a bit marginalized, and what they're doing is trivial. And I'm like, look, you've got Hamilton. What Hamilton taught you was ambition is a good thing, and saying something serious about America is a good thing. And I was reminding them that one of the things I have in the book is the night that Mike Pence went to Hamilton on Broadway. And Mike Pence is on Broadway, and they basically address him from the stage, and there's a bit of a confrontation. It makes the paper. There was also another confrontation in Chicago where a drunk guy This is actually a great story, which we reported a little bit in the Tribune. There was this drunk guy at Hamilton in Chicago, one just right after the election, and he got up in the balcony and he shouted out, "We won! We won! We won!"
Yeah, I remember that.
He just couldn't take the... Anyway, that's an aside, but so Pence goes and they have a thing with Pence, and then Trump, this is prior to Trump taking office, Trump tweets out, you know, Mike Pence badly treated last night, shame on Hamilton, and Hamilton sort of, so they get into a war with Trump. And I was telling these theater kids in Michigan, the first confrontational tweet that Trump did was about Hamilton.
Yeah, it was about theater.
About theater. Now, he did thousands in the years that followed. People will write books on his tweets, all of that. The first one, theater.
That's why this book is not only a great reading experience, it's deeper than that, too. Chris Jones, Rise Up, Broadway and American Society, from Angels in America to Hamilton. Your son, Evan, has to go to school tomorrow.
It's got early morning.
The book is available at Target and on various online...
Yeah, things. Amazon next week, I hope. So
Amazon,
but your pre-order. Get your
but
order.
But you get it at Target. It'd be a fantastic Christmas gift. See you in a few hours
All right.
at the office.
Thanks, Rick. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. We'll be back after a couple commercials. Paul DiRica is formerly the director of programs for the Illinois Humanities, but he is a talented historian and a great pal of mine. Paul, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you tonight?
Talented historian. Is that good enough for you?
That's great. That's better than I deserve.
It'll work. You got to explain some of this to me. The Illinois Humanities is celebrating the Illinois Bicentennial. One of the events is a free, all-ages live taping of Illinois Turns 200, which is a podcast series. That's going to be Monday, December 3rd at 7 at the glorious, wonderful, somewhat beleaguered now, Hideout. It's a seven-part series, right, Buck? Explain to me, will you?
Yeah, so what's going to happen on December 3rd, which is the bicentennial itself, will be a live recording of the final episode. So we've already done five so far, and we'll do the sixth episode on December 2nd, and then we'll have a big celebration on the 3rd.
Where have these previous ones been done? Across the state, I would imagine?
Oh, yeah, all across the state. So we started in Alton, and then we did an episode in Vandalia. And then last month, we did three in a row in Atlanta, Peoria, and Galesburg. And then on Sunday the 2nd, we're going to be in Ottawa, Illinois, before we wrap things up in Chicago.
Are they following the same format? The Hideout one sounds absolutely fantastic. It's interviews and dramatic readings and music, and you can't miss having Tim Samuelson at any event you're having, the great cultural historian of the city of Chicago and a wonderful guy. Have they all followed a similar format?
Very similar format. So what kind of ties the series together is we picked communities that arose along rivers or canals, railways, or significant roads like Route 66. So we used the state's transportation networks as a connecting thread. And then for each community, we kind of looked at that place's past, at its present, and possible futures for it. And we kind of told these stories through interviews with local artists and academics and historians, community leaders. Each episode, we paired our music director for the series, Chris Villillo, with a local musician.
Such an interesting, wonderful guy. He's been on this show a million times. You two guys, that's a nice team. You've asked certainly people mostly from those areas. I mean, Chris seems like he could be from anywhere. Do you know what I mean?
Right. So Chris brings that kind of statewide perspective to what we're doing, because he has a sort of encyclopedic knowledge of kind of all Illinois music. But then, each episode is kind of tailored to that particular community, and so we're kind of working with local people. And what makes the 3rd special is we're going to try to bring some of those people back and have them in the audience. So we're trying to get some of our former guests from Alton and Vandalia and Peoria and Galesburg and Ottawa to come to Chicago for this culminating event, so we can kind of acknowledge them there. And Illinois Humanities will cover their transportation and lodging. We wanted to be a statewide event.
What is this What has this been like for you? I mean, you know, I know you've been sort of organizing and orchestrating it, but there must have been a number of surprises and revelations and performers you've never met before. What's it been like for you so far?
Well, it's really fascinating just to kind of get to know different communities across the state. And, you know, the story that's often told about Illinois is it's kind of Chicago versus everybody.
Yeah, sure.
Right? And that's the narrative that gets played out over and over again. But you discover as you kind of travel around the state is there's actually a lot of things that kind of connect us, kind of historically, culturally, but even the sort of, like, challenges that, like, all of us are kind of facing today. And there's, like, really interesting and fascinating people all across the state who are doing good and creative work. And it's been an opportunity to kind of meet them and encounter them and learn about these histories. And also weird ways in which, you know, Chicago is connected to these communities. So Vandalia, right, that's the second capital of the state of Illinois.
Yeah.
And that's where the charter that actually, you know, made Illinois, or pardon me, made Chicago an actual city, that's where it was, like, drafted and approved. So and most Chicagoans don't know that.
I don't know
kind
that.
Kind of had our origin all the way down there.
Yeah. How long are the podcasts? The performances will probably be, you know, an hour, hour and a half, at least maybe two hours. What are the length of the podcasts?
Each episode runs about 60 minutes, and then the live events kind of stretch between, like, 75 and 90, and then we kind of edit them down.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk. You have, for more information, just go to IllHumanities, ilhumanities.org. We'll give you all the information you need. I don't know what more you need than it's Monday, December 3rd at 7 o'clock at the Hideout, which is at 1354 West Wabansha, and it's an all-ages live taping, which I think makes it great. Among the people, we've already mentioned Chris Villillo, who's an astonishingly talented musician. D. Alexander is also great. James Conway, John McClain. We have mentioned my great dear friend Tim Samuelson, and God knows whatever Tim does is fascinating. Don't you agree, Paul?
Yeah, and Tim's going to be doing a special segment where he's going to be focusing on the sounds of Chicago. So, you know, Tim has a vast collection of different objects, and so he's going to bring different things from the history of Chicago that make particular sounds, like a trolley bell or a like an old police siren, a Victrola player, and things like that. So people will get to hear what, you know, Chicagoans heard in their city, different points in its history.
And you've got historian Ann Durkin Keating, who I know very well, Tom Dija. Mm-hmm. Tom's flying in, is he? That's great.
Yep.
And my old friend from BZ, Natalie Moore, and one of the great people in this world, Nora Brooks Blakely. She's going to read her mother. She's the daughter of Gwendolyn Brooks, who wrote a pretty well-known poem, and a pretty damn good poem for Illinois, written for the 150th. Who is this young poet who's going to give us her take on the 200th?
Oh, Tara Betts.
Yeah.
Tara is wonderful. So she teaches creative writing at Chicago State University. She's the author of two collections, and the third that's forthcoming, and also is a respected editor as well, and knows Dora, and I think will produce a really great poem for the 200th anniversary. And it'll be the unveiling of that poem. So it'll be the first time people will hear that poem. It'll be the first time people get to try the burgoon made by the readers Mike Sula.
Oh my God, I forgot all about that. Yeah.
And we're even unveiling an exclusive beer that's been brewed for the occasion from Goose Island called Land of Loggers, which will be the only time you'll get to try it.
The Hideout has been known for great shows for many, many years, and I hope it goes on. There's some controversy now about trying to save that.
We need to get it landmark status.
One of a kind. Yeah, kidding. One of a kind place. Paul, you have the coolest job, don't you think? I know it's a lot of work and everything, but you know, this fits you so well, don't you think?
It's a lot of fun, and I get to work with some really great people. And what I, you know, most until I started this job, you know, pretty much everything I was doing was in Chicago. And what's great now is that I still get to do things here, but now I get to kind of do work all around the state, and even more so, I get to kind of connect people across the state.
Yeah,
work on joint projects.
You know, I think this is this sort of intensive Illinois bicentennial to do, we'll give you the opportunity to just tie this state together. You know, you watch the election coverage, and it's like, okay, yes, this is Chicago, and there's this big old state, and ooh, it's red here, red there. People do not really understand the vitality and the... Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of a place even like Galena, which people think of just as a tourist place. Galena was once, you know, the biggest city in this whole state. And to learn about the state enriches your feelings about whatever part of the state that you live in, I think. And, you know, to think that 200 years, and I was thinking, you know, it's 1818, Fort Dearborn came, and then it went, and then it came back in that time. Paul, you know how much I admire what you do, and knock them dead. I will try to get there, because there's so many of my friends doing stuff on the on December 3rd, 7 o'clock at the Hideout. How much is it to get in? It's free. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Free. The best price ever. You can go to ilhumanities.org to get more information, and also to get some information about Illinois Humanities, for which my friend Paul DiRico works. Paul, thanks a million for coming on.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks.
Can't wait.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Take care.
See ya.
Bye. Yeah, it does sound like a pretty amazing show. We'll get a couple commercials, and then you will hear, then we will go on a trip on Route 66 or Route 66, whichever way you like to say it.
Well, it's a rainy Sunday afternoon. It is not Sunday night, and it's a couple weeks ago, but my friend and old colleague, Wes Pope, is in here with an astonishing book. Wes, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Rick?
I'm good. I'm surviving. Now, you used to be a newspaper photographer, and a distinguished one. You are now teaching. What are you teaching?
I teach journalism. I teach multimedia journalism, so video, audio, photography at the University of Oregon, but I'm based in Portland.
Now, how do you find these kids? I mean, are they engaged? Are they worried about the future of so-called journalism? I mean, that's what would drive me nuts.
Well, all of my students are very engaged. I teach graduate students. Many of them are working professionals, and they're looking for new skills and new opportunities. And they are very hungry. And I think what has been fascinating is, especially in the last 2 years, we've seen a big swing toward journalism. So over the last 6 years, the first 4 years of my teaching, nobody wanted to do journalism.
Everybody, what they want to do?
They want to do storytelling. For corporations or NGOs or other types of work, and they wanted to retool and go do something else. And all of a sudden, with our last election, they all want to do journalism again.
That's fabulous. Your book, this is Pop 66, which you can read about in today's Tribune, Sunday, November 18th. Is one of the most unusual and magnificent books I have ever seen. In part, it's because of the way in which you shot the photos, but it's also, Wes Pope, you've grown up as a writer, my friend. And the writing in here, it is a narrative kind of, it's not a travelogue by any means. It's kind of a, you call it in the book, a time machine. And that time machine kind of started when you were coming to work for the Chicago Tribune in the late 90s. How did you decide to take the so-called Mother Road and come to Chicago?
Well, I had gotten the one-year residency at the Tribune. I'd lived in Chicago.
One of the great scams of all time in the newspaper business, I must tell you.
It worked well for me. So I had been at the Times of Northwest Indiana.
Yeah.
I had my moving truck packed and ready to move back to the West Coast. As I was leaving town, I got a call to go do an interview with Mark Hinojosa for the 1 year. And as I was driving across the country, I got a call from Mark telling me that I had the 1 year. So I went home for a couple months, and then I ended up coming back to Chicago.
You brought with you, and you tell this story in the book, you brought with you a pinhole camera or two, because you had just made for your mom, who's a teacher. You had just made a bunch of pinhole cameras for her students. Before we get into that, what is, and you've had to explain this to me, you and I collaborated on an early sort of piece to sort of for the book about Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. What is a pinhole camera, Wes Pope?
A pinhole camera is any light tight container with a tiny pinhole, preferably it's perfectly round, a very tiny hole, and that hole will only let light in one direction. And so just that, by having a tiny, perfectly round hole, it will create an image of what you're looking at upside down and backwards on the inside of the container. So I use soda cans, and I have a piece of 3-inch by 5-inch film that's wrapped around the inside of the can. And whatever I point my can at, I uncover the hole, leave it, I calculate the correct exposure, and it can be from 2 seconds up to maybe a half an hour if you're in low light. And then once it's done, I cover it back up, and it's created the image on the piece of film. And then I have, at the end of my trip, I process that by hand in a tray.
That seems to me so wonderfully prehistoric in an era where every idiot in the world believes that they are a photographer because they're, I don't, but I know that this phone on which I'm recording this can take pictures, but I don't do it often. What drew you to that?
Well, let's see, it was 1998, and I made pinhole cameras for my mom's fifth grade class, but I had at that point been in photography for 10 years.
Sure.
And I'd always heard about pinhole photography. I knew how it worked in theory, but I'd never tried it myself. So I had a couple months of downtime, and that's when I ended up making 30 cans for one for each kid in the class, and then they each did a self-portrait.
What did the kids think of this?
I think they were impressed. They asked a lot of good questions, as fifth graders do, and I think we had fun with it.
So you felt kind of compelled then, I think, having made all these things, when you're driving back to Chicago, you think to yourself, oh, I'm going to go and start taking photographs on Route 66.
So I went, I knew just from the song that Route 66 goes from Chicago to L.A., and that was the extent of my knowledge that I thought about Route 66. And so I went actually to a bookstore, bookstore in Orange County near my mom's house, and bought the two guidebooks I could find in there. And one was by Tom Snyder, and then the other one was by Michael Wallace. Mm-hmm. And I took those.
Michael Wallace, who has written the amazing introduction to your book, Pop 66, A Dreamy Pop Can Camera Odyssey Along Route 66. I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, in looking at, there is an incredible dreamy quality to the photos taken with a pinhole camera that Wes Pope has mastered in this book. But there is also something unbelievably telling and, I think, encouraging about the America that is detailed in this book. I don't want to get too philosophical, but I'll be back in a moment with Wes Pope talking about his book, Pop 66, which you can buy everywhere and which you can also read about in today's Tribune.
You are listening to a Rick Kogan experiment. A couple Sundays ago, Wes Pope was in town from Portland. He's not coming back until a couple weeks. He's having a book party at the one and only Billy Goat, the one on Hubbard Street, formal address 430 North Michigan Avenue, but it's below on Hubbard Street. He's going to have a party Tuesday, December 11th. But so thanks to Ben and Aubrey, I decided to record him on a phone, and it sounds okay. It doesn't sound too bad. Another part of Wes Smith is coming up after we get some commercials, during which I will tell you, hey, Bears fans, and man, they are just about to win the game. I think there's 2 minutes left, and they're up by 11. Hey, Bears fans, enter your chance to win 2 spots on the all-inclusive Bears fan trip to Cancun at chicagotribune.com/monster giveaway, courtesy of the Chicago Tribune. We got some commercials, and you'll hear more about Wes Pope and his travels on Route 66.
We're back with Wes Pope talking about his astonishing book, Pop 66. Wes used to be a photographer for Chicago Tribune and now teachers out west. Took this, sort of without knowing much about Route 66, started taking a sort of odyssey. You really, really got hooked. Did you get hooked on that first trip, Wes? On the first trip, was that when you met Roy Rogers and Dale Evans? That would probably hook you. How did that happen?
I came across Roy and Dale on the very first day of the very first trip. I stopped in Victorville, and one of my guides says, Roy Rogers fans and borderline necrophiles who want to see a stuffed horse should stop at the museum.
And you being a curious fellow said, I want to see a stuffed horse.
I want to see a stuffed horse. So I walk up to the front of the museum. There's a guy smoking out front, and he says, if you hurry, you can see Roy and Dale in there.
Wow.
And I said, I didn't even know they were still...
Did you know who they were? You kind of knew the names. You had to.
I knew them quite well because I knew my mom was a huge Dale Evans fan. And when she was a little girl...
There's a picture of her on a horse in the book. It's fantastic.
And I knew that she wanted to be Dale Evans. I knew she was a real heroine to people. My mom in particular was a huge, huge fan. So... But I had no idea they were still around. So I went inside, and there they were in the gift shop signing autographs. Roy is on a scooter that says on the front, it says Trigger 3.
God.
Dale's in next to him in a wheelchair. And so I waited my turn. Everybody was getting their autographs. And I took out one of the cans, and I put it in front of Roy, and I told him I wanted to take his picture with it.
And so he must have looked at you like you were – a lunatic. He probably said, I wonder if you've seen a camera like that.
What he said was, I ain't never heard that one before.
But he did allow you to shoot.
And Dale whacks him in the arm and says, he's probably telling you the truth. And he said, I didn't know he was, I didn't say he was lying, I just never heard that one before.
Interesting.
So they met me out back, and
And they indulge you because it takes a little while.
They let me set up, and as I was getting it all set up, Roy was giving me a hard time. Are you sure you don't have beer in there? He's giving me a hard time, and then we made the pictures, and they both seemed to get a kick out of it, and they each got in a separate minivan with one of their kids, and they drove away to separate doctor's appointments, and then that was it. He passed away a few weeks later.
That's an amazing way to start your odyssey. It had to almost make you even more curious as you proceeded. And I'm not putting words in your mouth, but curious to meet, I think, the people on the road. Is that true?
Definitely. I think the people throughout this project have been sort of the key that have kept me going. It's most interesting to stop and talk to the people along the way.
A lot of people think of Route 66 or Route 66, however you want to say it, as a bedraggled, off the main line. I find from your book, Pop 66, that this is America, man. Am I making too much of that, Wes Pope?
No, that's exactly how I feel. It takes you across every demographic, every political part of different part of the country. But it's I think there's it's sort of a magical place. And what I'm always looking for are these relics and these things that take us back to a different era on the route.
Well, also, you say in the book, or I just wrote it down in my notes, that it is kind of a time, what you have created here is a kind of time machine of sorts. It is not to a bygone America, but it's to a it's a little bedraggled, I'll give you that. But it's also pretty vibrant out there, yes?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think what I've seen, I've been working on this for 20 years, and it has changed a lot in those 20 years. Now you see preservation, and you see museums, and you see a lot of things coming back. But just over the course of that time, I think you see it's life. People are living living their lives. I went to high school football games along the route. I went, diners. I spent time with people. And
when you, did you have the feeling by the time you got to Chicago to start work at the Chicago Tribune that this was going to be as intense a kind of life project? You're talking 20 years, or as intense a life project. Did you know it then, or did it take another trip?
You know, I think when I first got to Chicago, I didn't know what I had. I knew it was
you have a new job, is what you have, you know, and that's pretty intense.
It was a cool. I knew it was an amazing experience I just had, and then it was a few weeks later I processed the negatives
and started to see.
And once I saw the negatives, you know, and I saw how they were turning out. Then it sort of. And even then, I wasn't sure what I had until I started showing it to other people. So people like Robin Doutridge and some of my
photo editor here,
some of my editors.
What was their reaction?
I got a really stunning reaction. So they were really, really positive. And there was really, this is something different people hadn't seen before, that there's something going on. And the first things I remember them saying were, you know, you need to keep going with this. This is really interesting.
Let me ask you a question, though. In taking these shots with the pinhole camera, there is no question it has created a unique series of images. Was there ever a thought of yours to go out and shoot conventionally and modern? Because there's also a story there in that, too. I think you captured something unique. But
on the very first trip, I was right up until I left, I thought I was going to still shoot with regular cameras and just I was going to do both.
Yeah.
And then for some reason, I decided to commit to it. And then I never looked back after that. And especially, you know, once I saw the images and I got the feedback, I realized they were doing something that was different than my everyday work. It looked different. It felt different. And I was getting a much different result.
I am talking with Wes Pope, whose book, this would be, I swear to you, the ideal Christmas gift book for someone who either likes photography or likes America. And that would probably be everybody out there listening. It is Americana told from a unique and artful perspective. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Well, thanks for listening tonight. Shortened a little by the Bears' victory, and coming up is the most entertaining and provocative Bears postgame show on the planet. Wes Pope and his Pop 66 book will be at the Billy Goat, the Hubbard Street Billy Goat, on Tuesday, December 11th, around 6 o'clock. You can buy the book, meet Wes, see these stunning, amazing, really amazing photographs of his odyssey. He's been maybe 12 trips back and forth on that legendary highway, and he takes them with this camera that gives it a kind of ghostly, dreamy kind of look. So drop by December 11th. I will see you next Sunday.